This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Do you revel in red meat or bask in the crispy goodness of bacon? If so, I bet this week's World Health Organization announcement was a real bummer. The organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer classified red meat as, quote, probably carcinogenic to humans, and processed meat as carcinogenic to humans. Ugh. Double whammy. However, clear guidelines like how much meat may or may not be okay to eat, well, they weren't provided. Joining me now to decipher this announcement and other selected short subjects in science is Ed Yong. He's a science writer for The Atlantic. He's based in London. Welcome back.
Hi, Eric.
Hi, Ed. So saying that red meat and processed meat could cause cancer seems like a big deal, but haven't we heard this before?
Right. So there have been large studies before showing that people who eat lots of these foods have a higher risk of bowel cancer than people who don't eat any at all. And some, you know, studies from laboratories showing the biochemical means through which these foods could lead to cancer. So we have definitely heard about this potential association before. What's happened here is that the World Health Organization has this arm whose job it is to look at things that could potentially lead to cancer and say how strong is the evidence that they could do so. And that's what they mean when they make their rulings. But I think the way this information is presented is deeply confusing and misleading to people. If you hear, like, red meat probably causes cancer, what you think is, okay, so if I eat lots of steak, that's probably going to cause cancer in me. And that's absolutely not what they're saying. They're saying that the evidence suggests that these things have the potential to cause cancer. Don't say anything about what the actual risks are. You know, if you eat more of this stuff, what are your risks of developing bowel cancer? They don't say. If you cut down and become vegetarian, do your odds decrease? They don't say.
Yeah, I can't give up that hot dog during World Series. I'm sorry. So, and you're right. It just sort of validates the idea, but doesn't tell you if there's a dose-related thing or not. How much it is.
Right. Or how much you should do. Really, what people want is good information with which they can make informed choices about their own lifestyle. And, you know, when it comes to meat, like I've cut down meat a lot in the last year or so. I only eat it maybe once a week or once every couple of weeks. But that's because I'm trying to lose weight. I have, you know, environmental concerns about the impact of red meat. And whether something affects my risk of cancer or not is just one part of that. But I think because cancer is so scary to people, it behooves organizations that give out information about it to make that information as clear as possible. Yeah, and that's not what's happened here.
Now, that's why we have you here today, Ed, to talk about it. Next up, you've got a look at genetic studies that focus on indigenous peoples. What has the relationship between researchers and indigenous peoples been like in the past? And what does your research show?
Well, it's been pretty fractious. So there have been some famous cases where scientists have taken blood samples from Native American groups under the auspices of doing research on things like type 2 diabetes, which affect them, but instead use those samples to study things like schizophrenia or inbreeding or migration patterns that contradict the tribe's own origin stories. And that's created an atmosphere of distrust among Native Americans for the genetics community as a whole. But I heard about a different story which took a more positive spin. So it starts in the same way. A Native American group called the Pima, who have been long studied because of a high risk of diabetes, but who have always been passive participants in that work and who've never really received the preventive services or educational services that were promised to them. So they took matters into their own hands. They started a partnership with a private non-profit research organization, and they became equal and active partners in that work. They decided what questions should be asked. When they gave blood samples, they did it on loan, and the researchers were actually more like consultants parents than people who steered the projects.
You know, there was a recent play by Deborah Zoloffer called Informed Consent, which is exactly about this, and we had her on talking about it. It's still a very interesting subject. You know, we hear so much about how TV screens and smartphones are ruining how we sleep. But is that really the case? Because there's some interesting new studies out about what a good night's sleep was like for our hunter-gatherers who never had that kind of stuff.
That's right. So this study looked at hunter-gatherer groups from Namibia and Tanzania and hunter-farmers from Bolivia. And they found that actually they contradicted a lot of these myths about the way people used to sleep. Now, obviously, these are modern people, but they give a sense of what life was like before the advent of light bulbs and TV screens and so on. So they sleep about the same as we do, no more. They don't have lots of naps in the afternoon, like some people have said, and they sleep in a continuous stretch throughout the evening, like we do. Like, there's this idea that people used to sleep in separate blocks and woke up for a bit in the middle of the night. That's not what we see here. So there's this tendency to assume that the way things used to be before the advent of modern life was so much better, and aren't things like televisions and modern technology ruining our health? And I think you need solid data to back up those assertions, rather than just, you know, going through some magical fantasy about the way people used to live.
Speaking about something really magical, you're bringing us a tale of murder. Tell us about these electric eels.
A shocking tale of murder.
Take it away.
Okay, so happy Halloween. So electric eels are a 2-meter-long fish, live in the Amazon, and they pack a hefty electric charge. They can create up to 600 volts from their own bodies. And this guy called Ken Catania has been doing a lot of work looking at how they actually use these shocks. First, they use it to make their prey give away their position. They produce small pulses that cause muscles to twitch, and a prey fish will twitch and reveal itself to the hunting eel. The eel then delivers a volley of very fast, very intense pulses, and that acts on the nerves that feed into its prey's muscles, causing all of them to contract. So it basically paralyzes a fish by forcing all its muscles to contract, very much like a taser firing into a person. And then it eats it, which is quite terrifying. Wow. But there's more. Do you have time?
Yeah, go ahead. You got about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
All right. So if the prey somehow resists it, the eel then curls its body to pinion the victim between its head and tail. And because it's like a battery, the head's the positive end and the tail's the negative end, this doubles the electric field experienced by the prey. And it basically wears out all of its muscles. It causes its muscles to contract so intensely that it duplicates the effect of like a full body workout in the space of a second, and allowing the eel to just take its time and swallow the victim.
Well, this is a true Halloween story. Thank you for taking time to tell us. Ed Young, science writer for The Atlantic, based in London, England. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And as we've been talking about, Halloween is here, and for some it's all about the perfect costume, right? Or decorating your lawn with the right balance of ghost headstones and ghouls. But to others, this spooktacular day means one thing above all else, and that's candy. Fistfuls of chocolates and caramels and gummy bears, which means we're all going to be eating a lot of sugar. And we all know how bad sugar is for us. So can there be any positives? Here to talk about the pluses and minuses of this annual candy binge is Roberto Ferdman. He's a reporter for the Washington Post who covers food, culture, and economics. He joins us from the paper's office in Washington. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Is there anything good about eating a ton of candy on Halloween?
Well, the good thing about Halloween, while it entails eating, you know, tons of sugary treats, which we know aren't exactly great for us, is that we're conscious of the fact that we're eating things that aren't very good for us. And you know what? We actually don't eat that much candy in perspective over the course of the year on Halloween. About 4% of all candy consumed in the United States is eaten on Halloween. That might sound like a lot, But it's okay, given that it's this temporary binge that doesn't continue. You know, we don't continue to eat candy through the following month, and it doesn't bring up our candy consumption over the rest of the year. So the good thing about Halloween is that we're conscious of the fact that we're eating candy.
Mm-hmm. And the bad thing about it is it's still sugar, I guess.
The bad thing about it is that it's still sugar. The bad thing really about sugar is that it is in our diets more than it has been before, and it is in our diets in subversive ways, in ways that it hasn't been before. So what's interesting about added sugar consumption in the United States is that the typical American only gets about 6% of their added sugar from candy. What that means is that tons of the sugar that we get is from things like juice and sweetened drinks and granola bars, which have candy, and fruit snacks, which some people and some institutions like the Center for Science and the Public Interest have contended shouldn't be called fruit snacks. They should be called candy.
So at least when you're eating the Halloween stuff, you know, as you say, that you're eating the sugar. But when you think you're eating more wholesome stuff, it's really loaded with sugar.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah. And so you're not saying that we shouldn't be eating candy. We shouldn't be binging out on this. You're saying that we should be aware of the other stuff we're eating during the year.
Right. So, I mean, it's not to say if you were to ask a nutritionist, would it be better if this child ate no candy or ate candy? The answer would almost always be ate no candy. But the answer is always that it would be better if the child ate candy knowing that they were eating candy than ate something thinking that it was good for them when it had just as much sugar as that candy.
Do you have a favorite candy, Roberto?
I really like dark chocolate, so I like dark chocolate versions of pretty much anything, especially when there's peanut butter in it too, which means dark chocolate Reese's Pieces are a weakness of mine.
Yeah, I'm a Hershey's Kisses guy myself, so I'm sure that. Happy Halloween, Roberto. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Roberto Ferdman is a reporter for The Washington Post who covers food, culture, and economics. After the break, we're going to be continuing with our Spooky Science Friday with a look at the microbiomes of monsters. Yeah, they got to have microbiomes too, right? But we'll talk about what's inside them. Speculate on these fictional monsters after the break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, on our beat, we're always looking for creative ways of talking about science. And Halloween presents us with a great opportunity, the spooky side of science. Imagine, if you will, running into a trifecta of Halloween monsters. You run into werewolves, vampires, and zombies. Well, how would you react? After the initial terror of these unsightly specimens of matted fur, fangs, and flailing flesh, you might realize, hey, these menacing monsters aren't so different from us. They got to eat. They got to find a way to survive. So like us, they must be teeming with microorganisms. Yes, these beasts might have a microbiome, viruses, eukaryotes, bacteria, each with their role to play in the composition of these creatures. In fact, thinking through the microbiomes of these Halloween monsters is a fun way to see what we understand or still need to learn about our own microbiome. So joining us now to talk about the microbiomes of werewolves, vampires, and zombies, Rob Dunn. He's author of The Wildlife of Our Bodies and a professor of applied biology at North Carolina State University. Amanda Hale. She is a doctoral student of zoology at North Carolina State University. They join us today from WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. We also have a beautiful infographic on werewolf microbiomes. This is gorgeous stuff from Neil McCoy. And we have a blog post called Monster Microbiology 101, written by Rob Dunn. You can see it on our website at sciencefriday.com/werewolf. Welcome to the program.
Oh, it's our great pleasure to be here, Ira. Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
We're happy to have you. Rob, what would a werewolf smell like?
I think it would smell like wolf or dog with a hint of man. So a little bit armpitty, a little bit wet fur.
Because there's bacteria that's living in the fur? Or
yeah, so I mean, every body of every animal is kind of like a template for the bacteria that live there. And so we know that our bodies, they feed specific things. And so in our armpits, we have these glands that feed bacteria that produce our armpit odors. But each mammal species has different glands and sort of a different template. And so if we imagine that magical transition from person to wolf, during that transition, these glands would be shifting around. And so you'd be going from something like that armpit smell to something like, you know, the special microbes that live in wet fur, so the weird Pseudomonas species. And so what's amazing is that although the werewolf is a fictional creature, this trajectory is actually really pretty predictable based on what we know.
Really? Our number 844-724-8255 if you'd like to participate, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Following this up a little bit, how similar are human and wolf's microbiome to begin with?
Yeah, well, so we know the most about dogs, and dogs are different from wolves, but if we extrapolate that, you know, some features should be similar enough, we have a measure of this if we look at houses. And so if we compare a bunch of houses in terms of which microbes live in them, we can actually tell if a dog has been in the house on the basis of the microbes that are there. And that's because the microbes of the dogs are really very different. They have specialized drool microbes that appear to help them in healing wounds. When they lick their own wounds, they recover more quickly, in part because of those microbes. They have really enlarged anal glands and a bunch of microbes that live there. And so nobody talks about this with the sexy werewolves, but I think they would have great big anal glands too. Those things are different. Their guts are also really different too.
Yeah. In what way?
The typical wolf diet has more meat and even some dead meat, some carrion, and so they have really acidic stomachs that serve as kind of a filter for what they eat, and it kills bacteria that might harm them. But then they have shorter intestines, and they're not quite as good at digesting, say, a celery stick. And so if during the transition to being a werewolf, to being a wolf, if you had been eating some celery beforehand, and then you get to, you know, your wolf stage, the wolf couldn't digest it. And so I think werewolves are very likely to be gassy, contingent on what they ate before.
No wonder they want real red meat once they're transitioned, right?
Yeah, it's hard to look so, you know, strong and fierce on TV when you're farting all the time.
Can we quote you on that? And they Twittered them. We'll actually, I'm sure, do that. Now, what kinds of microbes would a vampire need to digest a vampire? All that blood it's taking in, you know, he's eating.
Yeah, so the blood's actually really interesting. So blood is very nutritious. It has a lot in it, but it also poses problems for gut microbes. And one is that a lot of the immune activity that's in the blood, so in your blood right now, if somebody were to bite you and suck your blood, they would get some of the immune activity from your blood, which would kill a lot of microbes. And then the other thing is your blood has lots of iron, which can be really toxic. And so almost all the blood-feeding organisms that have ever been studied have both a way of dealing with that extra iron and specialized microbes that can deal with those immune cells. And so there's one group of microbes that's found in mosquitoes, leeches, ticks, vampire bats, and lampreys. Even though they're super different lineages of animals, they all depend on this same group of Aeromonas bacteria. And so almost certainly a vampire would have those bacteria.
Amanda, where do a lot of the microbes in our bodies come from? Do we just pick them up as we go along?
I mean, I don't know that we pick them up as we go along. I mean, a lot of it's influenced by our diet, the things that we intake, where we are geographically has a lot to do with the microbe composition in our guts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we get some during birth. You know, we get a big messy dose from our parents. That would be true of werewolves too.
Yeah, that's true. We're born with them. Rob, where do these blood breaking down microbes come from? For the vampires.
We actually have no idea. So we know that all these different blood feeding things have them. And so one possibility is that they're getting them from their parents. But how did the lamprey and the vampire bat come to share a common bacteria? We don't know. And so that would be, you know, if vampires existed, I think that would be a hot research topic to study, is how they get these.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple of comments coming through. For example, someone wanted, let me see if I get to that tweet that came in about what would swamp gas smell like? Where would we know that? Because, you know, it was always swamp gas in these things. What would the odor, is there a microbiome in there also?
In swamp gas, I would imagine it probably smells a lot like rotting eggs and sulfur, where you have I'm thinking about swamps, and you've got certain types of bacteria that put off almost a sulfur smell at times. That's what I would imagine swamp gas would look like. I don't know, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, so you've got some methane. I mean, I guess it depends on, is it the Scooby-Doo style floating swamp gas? And in which case, maybe a hint of Scooby snack?
Yeah.
All right. We have a phone call. Let's go right to the phone. So let's go California, San Jose. Hi, David. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering, if we had a really productive werewolf, you know, out and about roaming the night, wouldn't you say that, like, there would be a blood smell to his fur as well as a wet dog smell? It's kind of like, you know, tasting a penny or, like, a sodium salty smell to it.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's a good question. You would probably have the smell produced by some of these bacteria that are good at breaking down blood. Some of the things that you would find at a crime scene, you would smell on the fur. And so you would get that wet dog plus
coppery.
Hint of copper. You would smell a lot more wet dog than you would hint of blood. And probably you would know they were there because, well, people have phones enough. You get a nice photo of a werewolf, and so you wouldn't have to worry about detecting them based on blood smell.
Amanda, how do our microbiomes change when we die? What goes on inside our bodies?
Well, most of the microbes are concentrated in our gut, of course, and that's also, you have a lot of gases being produced from the fermentation processes going on inside the gut. And most of the bacterial activity that occurs in early decomposition when we die is actually from those microbes that are found in our gut. That's the most common bacterial diversity. And so they're actually starting to invade tissues and break them down and use the proteins and the lipids and carbohydrates that are available to them as a resource. And they're really responsible for sort of producing that decomposition fluid that's really common, and just the coloring and the smell and that fresh, bloody, putrescine odor that's really common in early decomposition.
Hmm. Explain, we've all seen so many zombies on TV and the movies. Why do they look the way they do, the way we think that they should do?
A lot of that is actually dependent on their microbial activity. Our typical zombies, they have that green coloring to them because of the compounds that are being produced by the microbe breakdown of our bodies. Mm-hmm. They tend to have skin slippage because as they digest the proteins and all in our epidermal layers, we start losing the adhesion that allows our skin to hold together. So that's why a lot of times you see sort of their face almost dripping. And also they sort of have that bloated appearance because of the gases that are being produced in their bodies. So all of that's really common to a rotting corpse. So the appearance of zombies to me is very similar to what I've seen in terms of early decomposition and any kind of carry-on.
Mm-hmm. Why would they be oozing their guts out like we see the zombies doing, like the Walking Dead thing?
Oh, absolutely. And it would depend on what kind of climate. I'd be more scared to find a zombie in the Arctic than I would in the tropics, simply because that process is much slower for the ones in the Arctic. And so they they probably hold together a lot better and have a better chance of infecting me and spreading whatever their mechanism is to create zombies. Whereas ones in the tropics, you're going to see that oozing happen a whole lot faster, and they're going to lose that putrescine odor and sort of transfer into that musky, funky smell that is common in later decomposition than in early decomposition.
A number 844-724-8255 if you'd like to talk about zombies, werewolves, anything that we're talking about having to do with Halloween and all kinds of stuff. If you could also tweet us at SciFry, SCIFRI, if you'd rather do it that way. Lots of tweets coming in. Do you think, DeCerbo wants to know, do you think vampires would love fruit, going off the thought that they share DNA with fruit bats?
So what we know about vampire bats is that vampire bats tend not, which are related to a lineage that includes fruit-feeding bats, they're not very partial to fruit. They spend most of their time focused on blood, and they've actually lost sweet taste receptors. And so even if you gave them fruit, they wouldn't find much joy in it. Their joy is in running up on something, biting down, and enjoying that blood, they're interesting critters. The vampire bats then go back, and they'll share blood even relatively altruistically with others who might not have been able to feed.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another, interesting, maybe they're sharing some microbiome when they're doing that too. Do vampires go back and share a little blood? When they do that, do they share some good microbes?
That's a good question. We'll have to answer that someday. We're talking about vampires, anything ghoulish this hour, especially about the microbiomes of vampires, werewolves, bats. You talk about it. With Amanda Hale and Rob Dunn on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. What happens if they, to a zombies, let's stick with the zombies. What happens would happen to a zombie's microbiome after a remainder a couple of days versus a couple of weeks? Would they have to switch back the microbiome around, or could they keep, from days to weeks? Amanda.
It depends on how fast their microbes are breaking down sort of their internal environment. We know once you die, your microbial diversity changes a lot as you progress through that process. And so I would imagine with zombies, they're going to pick up a lot of external bacteria as time goes on. So I'd imagine their diversity would increase the longer a zombie exists than when they initially were reanimated or possessed, however you view your zombies, that you would have a lot more species existing simply because it's a bigger haven for food resources and its own sort of ecosystem as a rotting corpse. And also because the smells that they give off, I watch a lot of shows with zombies, and I always wondered why you didn't see, a horde of zombies coming and then vultures following them and then maybe a pack of canines that are coming behind, because that smell, it brings, not only that, you've got these big fly masses that are sort of coming towards the horde. All of that's triggered by the odors that are given off by the microbial breakdown. And so, vultures are drawn to that smell, canines and other scavenging animals are drawn to that smell, but also flies and beetles and all sorts of insects feed off of that ecosystem. And it's all, driven mostly by odor succession.
But would all these animals become zombies themselves if they...
Well, that's an interesting question, Ira. It depends on your mechanism for infection. I would say... depending on the evolution of the viral species or the bacterial species that are involved in the infection, almost, yeah.
Yeah.
If they can jump species, then, biting these zombies, if they're able to infect with saliva and blood, then, yeah, you could expect them to also turn into zombie animals and see zombie vultures.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we'll get, there's a great discussion forming up now in the Twitterdom to talk about this, because they always talk about, you know, what might happen. Well, we're going to take a short break, come back more with Rob Dunn and Amanda Hale. Also going to talk about putrid smells that Amanda was talking about, how that sort of is formed. So stay with us. Our number 844-724-8255. Love to take your questions. Lots of tweets coming in. You can tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In case you're just joining us, we're talking this hour about the microbiomes of Halloween monsters. Hey, where else would you hear anybody talk about that, right? My guests are Rob Dunn. He's author of The Wildlife of Our Bodies and a professor of applied biology at North Carolina State University. Amanda Hale is a doctoral student of zoology at North Carolina State University. A number 844-724-825. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Representative Greer Martin wants to know, who is gassier? Werewolves or zombies? You opened that door, Rob, with the farting question.
I mean, internally, zombies.
Yeah, I would say that the gas of the werewolf is more focused, and so if you could stay toward the head, you'd be okay, whereas the zombie gas is sort of just
coming out from everywhere.
Yeah.
Huh. And how long, I mean, if you're a zombie forever, you keep making that gas all the time?
Oh, I guess if you're a zombie forever, you're sort of stuck in this decomposition stasis almost. So I would imagine so, since most zombies seem to be, you know, putrefying instead of decaying, then yeah, they'd continue to have this internal gassy environment, yeah.
One of the neat things we know about decomposition is it's a kind of war between different organisms, and so it would depend on who's winning. And so the bacteria, one of the reasons they're producing some of these smells is to compete with the things that also might eat the body. And so if the bacteria are winning, it will smell like this putrescine and other smells. Mm. But if the flies get there, the flies actually produce a lot of things that kill bacteria. And so you might get very different smells from the parts of the body where maggots have taken over.
Wow. Yeah, I would never, you know, I know that maggots attack corpses all the time, but that's an interesting take on that.
Maggots are drawn to corpses, but it's also a temperature thing. And so I would say the biggest competitors for bacteria in decomposition are maggots.
Let's see if I get a quick phone call in. Ed in Chicago. Hi, Ed. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you. I'm loving the show. This is great. My question is, there seems to be, listening to your panel's guests here, a high correlation between zombies and werewolves as represented in fiction and TV and so on, and the science that your guests are backing us into. So the question has to do with the zombie writers. Are they doing research, or they just get lucky by saying, well, let's have their skin fall off. Let's give them green skin, and let's make them smell.
Great question. Rob or Amanda, do they consult with, you know, folks like you?
I don't know if they consult so much, but I feel like the zombie myth itself kind of comes from our fear of the dead as a way to deal with, where we dispose of corpses, how we view them, and the process they're undergoing. So I do think there's a strong correlation between how writers have created zombies and the actual process that, you know, rotting corpses are undergoing. But Rob may be able to speak a little more to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think in general there's an interesting tension between our fears and science and what we fear at different times and the kinds of monsters we create. And so if you think about Frankenstein as another case example monster, you know, Mary Shelley is inspired by Erasmus Darwin and experiments that he's doing to shock frogs and maybe bring them back to life. And so I think there's this back and forth between the magic of monsters and science. And Frankenstein's interesting because what I've always wondered is, you know, does Frankenstein need a fecal transplant to keep going? And I think, you know, in retrospect, almost certainly. And so, I mean, the other fun thing about these monsters is that as we learn new things, because Mary Shelley didn't have the advantage of knowing about fecal transplants, as we learn new things, we can update how we think about these monsters. I think there's a lot of fun there.
It is. It's interesting you brought that up because we had a few people tweeting in asking about that, about mummy poop and stuff. We also had an audience monster pick, and we asked our audience to choose between mummies and the Headless Horseman. And after more than 700 votes, mummies won. So what would a mummy's microbiome look like? You're right. It doesn't have its own, you know, there's no guts inside a mummy left, is there, or is there? Does it have a microbiome?
Well, that depends on what kind of mummy you're talking about. Egyptian mummies are a little scarier because they're going to last a lot longer. They were properly prepared, eviscerated, so to speak. And so you don't have that gut microbiome really present to contribute to their breakdown. And, you know, they were treated with a salt mixture that prevents a lot of bacterial activity. Whereas some Chilean mummies and other parts of the world where mostly it's an environmental driven mummification, you didn't have preparation so their microbiomes do still exist.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I think that if you're being chased by an Egyptian mummy, it's bad news because they're kind of like beef jerky. They're salted and they're ready to deal with new conditions. Whereas if you have a Chilean mummy, I mean, we know from what's happening to Chilean mummies right now, they're starting to get wet with dew because of changes in climate, and they're turning to black ooze. And so if you're getting chased by a Chilean mummy, just run for water, and you're all clear. But an Egyptian mummy's after you, I mean, you're really in trouble. And I mean, maybe they do smell like beef jerky. That's probably known. I don't know.
That's a great
I don't know what Egyptian mummies smell like. That is a good question.
So somebody knows that. We just don't absolutely happen to know that.
Well, I'm sure we'll get the answers. Yeah. What is speculation? I want time for one last call from Charlotte, North Carolina. Tony, hi, welcome.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I was curious with the werewolf transformation, going back and forth between wolf and completely human, how long would the microbiome from a wolf survive in a completely human host?
So the
best cognate for that would probably be thinking about something like when you do a treatment on people's stomachs, on human stomachs, and change the acidity. And so when you change the acidity of a human stomach, you can change the microbiome really quickly because you let lots of new things in and the old things don't do as well because the stomach's kind of this filter. And so if we imagine all these sorts of physiological changes happening to the system of the werewolf as it makes this change, we can see a bunch of shifts, especially in the abundance of what's already there. Now, it may be the case if the werewolf needs special microbes to deal with its diet, that it might take a while to get those. And so maybe it has to share those with other werewolves, or maybe it comes from the food. And so you have this mix of things that are already there becoming more abundant or less abundant, and then the need for the new things. One of the interesting places we kind of see this is in children who are raised with dogs. I mean, I don't mean that dogs are their parents, but they're in the same house. We actually see the kids picking up fecal microbes from the dogs that become part of their gut microbiome. And so, I mean, that's kind of the closest we get to this transition, which maybe is less glamorous than what was originally imagined in the mythology and nonetheless exists.
It just shows you how much fun you can have with this and still learn something, you know, and still learn something about the microbiome. And it's been a lot of fun. I want to thank Amanda Hale, doctoral student of zoology at North Carolina State University, Rob Dunn, author of The Wildlife of Our Bodies, great book, and professor of applied biology at North Carolina State University. Thank you both for taking time.
Oh, thank you so
thank
much.
You
great pleasure.
Us.
You're welcome. And just a reminder, you can check out an infographic on werewolf microbiomes from Neil McCoy and a blog post, Monster Microbiology 101, written by Rob Dunn. It's all on our website at sciencefriday.com/werewolf.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. From my
if you've ever smelled rotted flesh, the scent of death, it's hard to forget. In animal studies, it's been shown that that particular smell is more than just repulsive. It can actually set off a warning signal in the brain. And now a team of researchers wanted to know if this happens in humans too, And they picked, of course, a college campus to test this out. My next guest is a co-author on the results published in the journal Frontiers in Psychology. Ilan Shrira is a visiting psychology professor at Arkansas Tech University in Russellville, Arkansas. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. It's a pleasure, Ira.
It's our pleasure. You're a psychologist. Why are you interested in testing the scent of death?
That's a good question. I've done some stuff, I and my colleagues have done some stuff on death more generally, how it sort of affects us and affects our psyche when we think about it. And then we got interested in scent, and we're sort of interested in similarity between animal models and human models. So we learned about lots of, or some research on animals that exposes, and you described it very well in the introduction, that the sort of the scent from decaying bodies, the rotting flesh, and we started by isolating one of the signature components, the signature scent called putrescine, that is released when the breakdown of rotting tissue, rotting flesh, so it smells very rotting. And so we ordered some of that through a chemical company, and we used that to prime people, expose people to that, and wanted to see how it affected people, just focusing on humans.
And how did it affect people?
It affected people. We were mostly in the ways that we thought, primarily that it seems to be the exposure to the scent of death. I mean, first of all, in animals, obviously scent is a much more primary, dominant sense than it is in humans. So animals, other animals are going off scent more than we humans are. But what in animals, this exposure to putrescine does cause certain specific behaviors across animal species, particularly avoidance and escape behaviors, getting away as though there's some sort of danger, either with nearby predators or possibly the risk of contracting an infection from the dead bodies, from the carcasses. So there's a tendency mostly to flee the area, and in some cases, because there might be predators around, just to increase vigilance and the potential for aggression, readiness for aggression, mm-hmm. should animals encounter it in those situations.
Talking about the smell of death, this hour on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with someone who studies, psychologist who studies this, Ilan Shrira. Tell us, is this sort of a pheromone? You know, we know pheromones are those smells that people give off. Is it the same thing?
Pheromones are a bit different. We were careful not to use the term pheromones because in the scientific world, it's used in a very specific way, and it's used as a means of communication between two organisms within the same species usually. But it's almost always something that's released through bodily fluids while one is alive, like most notably body sweat, saliva sometimes. So it seems to be a way of communicating, much in the same way visual forms of communication or languages, mm-hmm. whereas putrescine is something that is communicated not necessarily intentionally after one person has died.
And it's really a strong, pungent odor. People, you smell it once, you know it forever.
Yeah, it's distinct. I mean, so just as the scent of corpses and carcasses is very distinct and powerful, this is, I guess it's sort of difficult to describe, but it does definitely smell rotten. And to me, it's distinct that it sort of has this weird, unpleasant, fishy smell.
Different
rotting smells. Go ahead.
In your study, you expose people to, I understand, either putrescine or some ammonia to see which one, you know, to test the difference, but whether they would run away or not. And you found out that they really do avoid the putrescine?
Yes, that was the interesting thing. We wanted to make sure, first of all, that it wasn't just an unpleasantness that they were trying to escape from. So ammonia is an unpleasant scent that's commonly used in scent studies as an aversive stimulus. And so, yes, we exposed people to ammonia, putrescine, and then a control condition, just water. And after smelling the putrescine, people were quicker to walk away So we did the experiment outside on campus. We approached people, and after they did this scent test, and they rated the scent on different dimensions, and they subjectively rated the ammonia and putrescine as just about as equally repulsive and unpleasant. But when they walked away, we sort of had somebody waiting in the bushes behind the tree and clocked them, and after smelling the putrescine, they were walking away a bit more than 10% faster.
Wow.
Than the ammonia, even.
And this is something you can do at home if you want to. You can buy these odors, right, and from a lab supply house. Maybe a little late for Halloween. I don't know, overnight shipping? Thank you very much, Ilan, for taking time to be with us today.
I appreciate it. It was a pleasure.
Ilan Shrira is a visiting psychology professor at Arkansas Tech University in Russellville, Arkansas. One last thing before we go. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about Halloween hacks with spooky projects you could make, from slimy eyeballs to remote-controlled skeletons. And we asked you for your own thoughts, and here is one that was sent in.
What we have is a ghost mobile. It is suspended from a branch about 60 feet off the ground with a 60-pound strength fishing line and hangs from two sticks, one large one and one medium-sized one. The ghosts are life-size. They are made of styrofoam wig heads covered with cheesecloth, and the shoulders and arms are hinged so that they move like real arms, and they have counterweights on them so that they wave realistically. When the wind blows, this mobile goes all over the place and does all kinds of fancy things that people love to watch.
Yeah, so if you need a last-minute Halloween, you know, lone ornament or something like it, you can build that spooky ghost mobile. Before we go, one last thing. We want to remind our fans in Minnesota, next Tuesday, November 3rd, we're bringing our live stage show to the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, and we want you to join us. We'll have an X-ray gun and an ultrasonic glove and a real-life Back to the Future 2 jacket that shrinks before your eyes as we talk about the science of superpowers. And we're going to even perform an experiment on the crowd. So you want to be in that crowd, please, at the Fitz. You don't want to miss it. Get your tickets at sciencefriday.com/Minnesota. Charles Berkowitz is our director, senior producer, Christopher Intagliata, Alexa Lim, our associate producer, SciArts producer, Annie Minoff, Luke Gruskin, our video producer, production assistant is Becky Fogel, Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman, our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Hope to see you next Tuesday on the 3rd, live on stage at the Fitzgerald in St. Paul. It's going to be in the evening, so you can get out of work and join us then. Get tickets at sciencefriday.com/Minnesota. Have a happy Halloween. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.